De la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means
necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
I am a pinch hitter for this panel, as well as a impromptu moderator, I guess. My name is Michaela Brangen. I am on the National Political Education Committee Steering Committee of DSA. And I am in North New Jersey DSA, formerly of River Valley, which is in Western Mass. Welcome to the panel, everyone, on aging as socialists, aging in socialism, however you would like to read that. I helped to try to gather some people for this panel. Unfortunately, Peg Strobel and Bill Barclay cannot join us today. They are what I like to call seasoned comrades, older folks, and they decided not to take the risk for COVID reasons. However, I will be talking about the DSA Archives Project, which is something that Peg and I kind of helped to make together, and talking a little bit about Peg, but then also talking about my perspective working on that and hopefully opening it up to a discussion about how, as socialists who have a historical materialist analysis, what we do when we start to move through the movement, not only what we do with our own things, but what we do with our own selves, our own bodies, and how we relate to each other. So I'll pass it down below.
I don't like having a stand. So howdy, everybody. My name is Mina Parkinson. I am an organizer with DSA from Middle Tennessee DSA. I live in Nashville. I've lived in Tennessee my entire life. I will say becoming an organizer was the second best decision I've ever made in my life. The first best decision that I ever made was coming out. When we were kind of planning this panel, I kind of sarcastically and half sarcastically wanted to call it coming out as a socialist. Because that was such a weird situation I have to go through. Might be best for us to just like go down the line, but I've been an organizer for 8 years now. And it has been one of the best decisions. I've met some of my best friends, got married, and have been in the struggle long enough to have seen quite a bit happen. But I will yield the rest of my yapping over to you.
Thank you. So yeah, hi everyone. My name is Alex. I'm from New York City DSA. I'm also a member of DSA's National Political Committee. I think the format of this panel has changed a little bit, but I was originally going to speak about my experience as a younger person organizing and someone who has been organizing since I was a teenager in high school. So I first began organizing when I was 16. I'm 24 now. And I guess I'll just use this time to maybe talk about how we can make DSA more accessible for younger comrades, as that's a very important demographic. But I first joined DSA after the 2016 Bernie Sanders campaign. That definitely changed the way that I view politics. Like through his campaign, I realized that change is not made on an individual level. It's rather made on a movement level. And once his campaign ended, I knew that I cannot simply just stop organizing. That would really be a betrayal to the newfound values that I learned, which is what led me to DSA. And many young people who join DSA start off in YDSA when they're maybe in high school or college, and then graduate on to what's known as ODSA or old DSA once they graduate. But for me, it was a little bit different, where I first joined DSA, as I said, when I was 16, and then about a year after that joined YDSA and was pretty consistently organizing in both spaces. So this meant that there were times when I was like a teenager and organizing alongside people who in some cases were double my age. So as many of you can imagine, it can be quite intimidating to be the youngest person in a room where everybody is talking about politics and there's decision making happening. And I think that we have to be very intentional about recruiting and retaining younger comrades. And I think that the goal of older DSA people, whether they're functioning as mentors, who are organizing alongside, whether it be high school or college students or people who are younger than them, should not be to like manage them, should not be to educate them, but should rather be to foster their growth and development as a socialist organizer. And sometimes that means that we must intentionally step back and be very conscious of not taking up space to allow for a younger, maybe more or less experienced person to be in the driver's seat. Sometimes we have to let younger comrades make mistakes and be like, wow, I think that's a really dumb idea, but I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to try to convince them because them experiencing doing something is ultimately the way that they can learn about that the best. And ultimately, like, I think it is our job to offer our experience, offer our advice to younger people joining DSA, but then leave it up to them on whether or not they want to act on the advice or how they want to use that experience. And ultimately, I think it's very important that our younger comrades in DSA, our comrades in YDSA, feel just as empowered to be political leaders and to make political decisions and to participate in political debates. And I was very fortunate to have many comrades who really took me under their wing when I was first joining DSA. And upon reflecting on that, I realized it was because they did treat me as an equal. And they assumed that I had as much to contribute to the organizing space, they had much to contribute to the socialist movement as they did. And because of that, they expected me to act in a way that reflected that. So they set this very high expectation, and that allowed me to meet that expectation. And you know, I grew up in New York City, and I decided to stay in New York City for college mainly because it was one of the many epicenters of DSA and socialist organizing. And I'm sure as many other young people who have been organizers hear all the time, if people say, "Well, the youth are the future of the socialist movement," right? And that is very true. But it is not complete because young people are also building the socialist movement right now. Right? And if we look at the last year, we have seen young people, many of them college students, who brought a wave of unionization at Starbucks and Trader Joe's. And just a few months ago, we saw thousands of young people occupy their campuses, defy the police in order to demand an end to the genocide in Palestine. And I was active at the encampment at City College, and I think that the encampment highlighted the both the potential of student organizing, but also many of the weaknesses that it has. So I think the encampment once again showed the real potential among college students, among young people, for creating a radical and militant and effective protest that directly challenged the power of the capitalist class. But it also meant that many students who had become politicized by Palestine, who had maybe began organizing just a few months ago, were now charged with leading one of the most biggest and historic uprisings in recent American history. So, you know, that this is not a like to trying to critique the encampments, but rather to critique the way that we have been engaging in student organizing. And how there has been a real lack of investment in student organizing on college campuses, and this real potential, I don't think, has fully been realized. However, YDSA did pass a resolution at a recent convention for a student strike for Palestine, which hopefully will take place at the beginning of the next administration. And that, I think, is very much the next step in the encampment movement, the next step in the student and young people movement for a free Palestine. And I think that we can all imagine how much more, how powerful, how effective, how militant that strike or any future actions will be if the people who are leading it have been have experience organizing in DSA, being mentored by DSA comrades, and have a very clear vision for building a mass multiracial democratic movement for Palestine. So ultimately, I guess just to close, I think that we should, you know, view in like investing in young people, we should not just do that because it is the nice thing to do or because it is the right thing to do, but we should ultimately do that because it is necessary for sustaining and building a socialist movement and ultimately defeating capitalism.
Thanks. I'm going to bounce off of Alex here, in part because there's a bit of a segue. I can say a little bit about myself. I too got my start organizing in a college, but it was in graduate school when I organized my student union at Cornell. The second failed attempt, third time's a charm. They actually finally just won their election after I graduated. I had to graduate for it to happen, you know. But I was a leader in the effort in 2014. Through 2018, we lost our election by 81 votes of a bargaining unit of 3,600. And I learned everything about organizing, you know, everything up till now, and then more in DSA later. And joined DSA, like many people, because I was a Bernie-crat, and then figured out once Trump was elected and my time in grad school was coming to a close, I was like, I need to organize. I need to continue to organize. And so I joined DSA. And then my first job continues to be my job is as faculty at Amherst College in an interdisciplinary law department. And just to say also, I've, you know, been honored to serve as a mentor to YDSA chapters forming in the Valley where I lived up until recently. And also as a person who values education and mentorship because both of my profession as well as knowing what I both valued when I was organizing and what I wish I had had, looking back on some of the organizing that I got my start with, made me feel very invested in projects of political education within DSA and how those relate then to better organizing, creating more and better socialists, but also creating connections between different generations of socialists. Because, you know, DSA just celebrated its 40th anniversary a couple of years ago. If we, you know, call the 1982 unification of the New American Movement and the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee the formation of DSA, then this is an organization that's been around for a pretty long time, and lots of people are still in it. How many of you have been in DSA since the DSOC days? Anybody? Well, we don't have anybody here. But I can see that there are a lot of people who are, you know, working, you know, diligently throughout their maybe their cusp of retirement years, as well as lots of young people. It's actually really great to see a lot of people who are, you know, kind of interested in this topic, even if you're not, you know, maybe feeling aged at this point. Like I mentioned, Peg Strobel and Bill Barclay can't make it today. But Peg was one of the people who a few years ago started to get funds together, a massive fundraising effort to process the DSA archival papers at the Tamamint Library at NYU, which is the left archive at NYU. It's public, it's free. So if you're ever in New York City and wish to go, you can go for free. And at the time, and I still am on national political education, but at the time, I thought, why don't we teach chapters how to do this too? We have in DSA scores of chapters of all different sizes. And archiving is something that you might think of sometimes like sort of intellectually as like, this is the thing that takes place in libraries. But really, archives are things that not anybody can make, but anybody can begin the process of archiving collectively. It's about storing our collective, not just our ephemera, but also our collective knowledge so that we can pass it down to others. This is great aesthetically. I'm sure some of you have, you know, been to museum exhibits where, you know, an archive is like kind of like put on display for everyone to see. It can be very beautiful, but it can also be incredibly practical for organizing and for not having to reinvent the wheel every single time we try to do a project. One of Peg's anecdotes or one of Peg's examples here is about, you know, why in 60 years from now someone is writing the history of the struggle for affordable housing. If grassroots organizations that fought for affordable housing haven't put their records in a repository, that historian's account will likely focus on how developers and government agencies brought us affordable housing. So the idea here behind archiving as socialists, besides just sort of saving the things that other people have put their effort into, is in order to be able to learn and to be able to have the resources to mentor, for example, YDSA chapters who are getting off their feet, or any other campaigning. So we did put on two of those workshops over the course of last year. We were going to put on a third one, but that's when Palestine kicked off, and we had it scheduled for precisely today when everyone was going on out on the very first sort of mass action in November. So we've put that on hold for now. But I can say just today, somebody who was in a chapter, they were like, as soon as we went to that, or as soon as members of our chapter went to that archiving workshop, we went and started archiving our stuff. And it covered two aspects. It covered both material archiving, so the stuff, the posters, the swag, all of that, as well as digital archiving. The ability to be able to keep records and keep them, you know, in order to pass down to leadership as well as rank and file members, and have a record of both, you know, your meetings and all of that stuff that you need to have, but also a record of your organizing. So I'll maybe talk a little bit more about it later. That sounded almost like it was a commercial for the Archives Project, but I'm really excited to start those up again. But now our fourth member has joined us. This is Megan Romer. Megan Romer is one of the co-chairs of DSA National, as well as an at-large member of our org. And I'll just pass it on to you, Megan.
Sure.
Yes.
Mina has yet to go.
Okay, great. So Aging is Socialists, helping older socialists use technology so they don't put the panel on their calendar at 3:30 and show up like super early at 3:15. Like what? Why is the door closed? Oh God. All right. So yeah, that actually is a theme that we may want to talk about technology. But, yeah, my name is Megan Romer. I'm not that old. I'm 40. I turned 41 in less than a week. So you can tell me happy birthday anytime. Thank you. I joined DSA as a mom. I already had a kid. He was 8, I think, when I joined. And my first job in DSA was being the snack mom, because there was no way for me to attend a DSA meeting at 6:30 at night and not be able to feed my kid. So I had to make food for the kid anyway. So I would make a big, I was in Southwest Louisiana. I'd make a big, usually pot of red beans and rice, vegan, so everybody could eat. We had our meetings in a space that was next to the bus station where a lot of houseless people slept. So we'd just make, you know, you can feed like 50 people with $20 with red beans and rice. So we'd make a big pot, feed our houseless neighbors, feed ourselves. And that very simple act made it possible for me and a whole bunch of other parents to participate in DSA. We didn't have like a fancy kids program. We'd give him a bowl of food and stack him in the corner with a couple of Nintendo Switches and tell him to have a blast. And it worked great. It was fine. Part of that, though, was that we had a culture where that was fine. Kids sometimes make noise. It's fine. You want to hear kids making noise because that means that the movement is alive, right? If anybody is coming out of religious movements, I had a pastor who used to say the two best sounds in a church are crying babies and unfolding chairs, because that means you've got people coming in. And he would say that when people would complain about crying babies. It's like, no, it's good, actually. So that was my intro to DSA. And then did that for a couple years, and that was fine. And then mid-pandemic, actually, I should say early pandemic, my kid loved going to DSA meetings so much that the first thing he was sad about was, he was like, oh, we're not going to school. Oh, we're not going to DSA. He loved it, right? It was like basically unlimited screen time, first of all. Like, go in the corner, watch your iPad, it's fine. But he liked it. He liked being in that sort of mixed generational space, sort of, he'd kind of listen in, pick up little things here and there. But yeah, it was sweet. It was a sweet time. He's 14 now, and much less sweet. but mid-pandemic, it was just after the vaccines came out. My father-in-law, who lived in New York City, and he was 95 at the time, and he was living alone and perfectly healthy. He had those great, like, Ashkenazi jeans where you just like live forever and you're super healthy. We all know that guy, right? Like, I know anybody who's in New York. Yeah, you know that guy. So he was that guy. But he got cancer and it metastasized. And he was given a few months to live. So it was again mid-pandemic. There were no healthcare workers. So we packed all our stuff into a storage unit, got in the minivan and drove to New York and proceeded to, he was given, I think, 3 months and he lived 18 months because, again, he's that guy. We were in lockdown for an extra year or so longer than anybody else was. And I did almost entirely remote organizing because I had to. I was the chair of a national working group. I continued to work with my chapter back at home because that was everything was remote anyway. I did some things with New York, but mostly they were doing stuff in person, and I wasn't able to because we couldn't get COVID and bring it home to a, well, I mean, he was dying anyway, but we didn't want him to die a miserable death of COVID. Like, that was, it was already bad. So we did that. I had lots of sitting up late at night, and it was a really nice opportunity to finally read some theory. I'd been mostly not doing that. And so, you know, I usually took the overnight shift and would sit there and somehow keep myself awake reading Marx and Lenin. I don't really know how that worked. There was coffee also. But so that's my experience. And somehow, you know, I managed to stay active the whole time. But it wasn't always easy, and there weren't always opportunities to do things when I was not able to do things in person or when I had to do things asynchronously. So I made a lot of my own opportunities because I'm stubborn and just going to do it anyway. One of the things I started was doing like weird off-time poly-ed groups through the National Mutual Aid Working Group. We would do like midnight reading groups and lunchtime reading groups. And they were shockingly well attended because it turns out people have third shift jobs or they have babies or they're just weird sleepers or whatever. And it was great. So those kinds of little things, these little, it only takes one or two people to do them, feeding people, making some asynchronous options, doing things so that things can be done online, virtually, as well as in person. And I never want to discount the value of organizing in person. It is so important. I'm so glad to be physically here with you all. Missing my son's first day of high school. I know, it's fine. He's like, I don't care, Mom, I don't care. So, all right. But yeah, so I think we sometimes make this like this huge deal. How are we going to incorporate parents? How are we have to come up with a whole, like, you actually don't. You can just make sure there's food and maybe a stack of kids' books. It's cool to do more things. And we do have a DSA National Resource Drive that has a bunch of lesson plans and printable coloring sheets and things like that. Especially if you're working in a bigger chapter or not in DSA, in a bigger organizing space where you might need to take, you know, a dozen kids off to a separate room and entertain them because they're too rowdy. But the amount of work it takes to incorporate people who are coming in different life spaces and phases is not as high as we sometimes make it be. I think it is a fairly low bar to clear. You just have to remember to do it. And part of remembering to do it is listening to people who are coming at you from different times and phases in their life. So I will pass it off to Mina.
Yeah, my appearance on this panel was a little funny. So I turned 32 back in July, and then one of my younger trans comrades referred to me as an elder, which I was like, that's really rude.
How dare you?
Guy Brown invited me to come on this panel about ATS the Socialist, which I'm going to choose to believe it was because of the coming out thing and not turning 32 as a trans woman. But that is like a real thing. Like, our life expectancy is like low, like really low. And it sucks. It's something that like you have to think about and that you have to like recognize. And like, as somebody... So it's hard to talk about this, like coming out as a socialist, as somebody like, because I started organizing before I transitioned, and my parents were pretty chill with that. They're like, oh, wow, you're doing such cool stuff for, you know, the labor movement. And, you know, none of them were like union people or anything like that. They were just like kind of your bog standard, like good progressive Democrats. And that was fine for a while. Like, they were glad that I was getting into politics, and probably some of you people in this room probably had the experience of, you know, you're involved in politics, when are you going to run for office? And like, I might be a pervert, but I'm not that big of a pervert. I don't think that highly of myself, and I don't think other people should either. Apologies to some of the chairs on here. But I was one of the founders of my DSA chapter. I have served on the steering committee quite a bit. Throughout the time, I have helped found projects, helped lead organizing campaigns across the spectrum of different types of stuff. So my name's on a lot of things. Well, my old name, which is really quite interesting, because I will have people like look at our, you know, chapter inbox and be like, who is this? I'm like, he's dead, man. That guy died a long time ago. Don't worry about it. And even going to like the 2017 DSA convention, which was my first DSA convention, which was like, I reflect back on it, and it's like one of the best experiences of my life. Just a year later, like everything in my life changed. So like, I realized so much about myself, and I think a lot of other trans comrades might have had this experience of like, oh, wow, here's this queer and trans rights thing. I don't really know anything about it. I'm going to start going to all these reading groups and all these events and like learning more about it and talking to these trans people. I see a few trans people giggling to themselves, and you're like, oh, shit, that's me. Oh, my God. And it's like someone like pointing a gun at you. And it's like you have to come to this realization of like, what am I willing to lose for the things that I want to gain? And that's really tough, because I grew up in Tennessee, and even though like I had like good, quote unquote, Democrat family and, you know, people in my life who were from rural backgrounds, more conservative backgrounds, like I've had those people in my life my entire life. And I really had to like contend with the idea of like, if I do this thing, like I might lose those people. And guess what? I was right. I did. And that sucks. Like, it does suck. It's a reality that a lot of queer people and trans people face, of even though my family, good bog standard Democrats, like they don't talk to me anymore, and I don't talk to them. Like, fuck them. Who cares? And you know, the only person from my family that I really talk to anymore is my brother Hunter, who also stole my bit and came out later after me. I know, right? He's great. Not very political, but he is entertained by my stories about all the dumb shit that I do. So I lost all those people. You know, I wasn't very much connected to my, you know, extended family. We live all across the country, but, you know, not being able to come out to people meant that I couldn't be around them and that I couldn't talk to them. And that, like, really meant, like, the de facto separation of myself from, you know, my blood relationship. But honestly, the part that was easy was coming out in DSA, which was awesome. Like, I was super afraid of doing it, but everyone was like astoundingly chill. Maybe it's because I had built up so much political capital that people couldn't talk shit to my face or in meetings about it. But, I really didn't have that many problems. It, you know, obviously a few slip ups here and there, some invasive questions, some weird questions, but also questions from people who thought they were men and then needed to talk to me in private after grabbing a drink. And really trying to get that understanding of, like, my perspective as somebody who transitioned and understanding, like, what the consequences were, because there are consequences, whether you are, you know, the consequences of getting married, the consequences of having children, the consequences of getting older, and what that means for your space in the movement. It's something that we almost, like, passively ingest, but never, like, stop to really think about it. And if you don't, you can kind of get left behind, because not everybody in this movement is thinking about it. And if you're not thinking about it and they're not thinking about it, then you could just get left in the dust. One thing that's been great about, I will say, my chapter is it's been, upon reflection, entirely led by queer women, if you catch my drift. And that has really fostered a culture, like, it with really sharp teeth when it comes to trans rights and queer rights. You know, enforcing things and making sure the spaces that we go into are accepting and that are putting queer and trans rights first. You know, that was one of, you know, coming out in the socialist movement was one of the best decisions that I made. And I was willing to make the sacrifice of losing the rest of my family if it meant that I got to keep my comrades and be who I was and find the people who I could love and be a part of this fight in a genuine and real way, in a way that, like, made me be able to fight better. And, you know, special shout out to the women in DSA, especially, because the women that I hung out with did not have the same kind of, like, prescribed femininity that the rest of the women in my workplace or in other places had. You know, I fully admit, like, we were all dirtbags, like, you know, getting drunk, doing drugs, like, just being, like, rowdy and rough and coarse and, like, mean to men in a way that they were not familiar with, and a way that really made me think, like, I didn't have to change my entire fucking personality to be who I wanted to be. I could still be me. I'm still the loud, annoying, brassy, very opinionated person. And I didn't have to, like, change every aspect of who I was. And I'll end it here and pass it along so I can give other folks more time. But, you know, there's this saying that I read recently that, you know, red is the first color of the rainbow. And I think about that a lot. I'm a communist first. Like, as much as I am a trans person, the trans flag doesn't necessarily represent me. The red flag does. And that is who I am. That's what's going to be on my grave. And I am greatly looking forward to continuing to be the loud, annoying, brassy, opinionated woman in the room, and being a trans woman there, because you need that counterweight. So I'm going to pass it along because I could keep talking about this stuff for hours because I'm talking about myself.
What are we doing next?
Actually, I have a question for all of us. So something you said, Mina, about people kind of trying to figure out how to handle your coming out, it made me think, I mean, we're speaking here about aging, but, you know, that's a metaphor, can be a metaphor for a lot of things. It can just be a metaphor for moving from one stage to the next, right? What about when people are not in that stage, right? And we're in a multi-tendency organization in the left movement in the U.S. For those of you who aren't in DSA, you know, we are multi-tendency, often factional. But sometimes we don't always think as, you know, because we're socialists, we think structurally, we're not always thinking necessarily about other forms of stages or other forms of tendency, right? And we're I'm speaking here about intergenerational conflict, really. And something that I think about as an organizer within DSA, I'm also on the Growth and Development Committee, too. So I'm doing both, you know, national political ed work, growth and development, and about the ways in which people in different stages of their development, political development, but also in just their life stages, often may not have the most sympathetic relationship to you, because maybe they think the thing is, you know, it doesn't matter, or you're too young, or you're too old, or you're too whatever. And this is, you know, how many of you are familiar with Joe Freeman's The Tyranny of Structurelessness? Classic text, right? And something she talks about in there is the way in which the elites end up in the elites. And she's talking here, of course, about the second wave feminist movement. And she says, you know, either it's you're single or you're married or you're a lesbian or you're not. And so I kind of wanted to see what, before we get to maybe questions and people can, you know, dig into individuals a little bit more, what or how we think about intergenerational conflict or interstage conflict in DSA or in leftism. Because another big part of this, too, is that sometimes we're always just like, but we're all comrades, right? So we can stand it. So, yeah, I just wanted to open that up. If it looks like, Mina, you might have something to say, but I would love to hear from everyone.
I was zoning out a little bit, so thanks for cracking the whip. Yeah, it's a good question. On a political practice, you know, the work that we do, I will say it's hard to be a party line type of person when not everybody else is. when, like, if you win the vote, like, the point is in the organization is that you're, like, everybody needs to fall in line. As a party line type person, I am a fan of that. It's not always the case. You know, like you're saying, it's multi-tendency, so not everybody believes in that, and they can take their ball and go home and not care about it. Oftentimes it's, you know, being who I am, demonstrating to other people that you are just like normal. And that I won't say that this is a good idea for every, you know, I'm speaking to the trans people in this room more specifically. I don't think that you need to supplicate yourself and respond to all of the probing questions, all of the invasive questions or the snide comebacks or anything like that. I don't think you need to bend the knee and just go along to get along. I think however your response is, I've chosen my response to really to believe that these things come from a place of care. I understand that, like, the vast majority, if not all of my coworkers, I am the only trans person that they've ever met. And that means that they don't know what the hell to do with me sometimes. They don't know how to cope with it. And, like, they might mess up or say something rude or anything like that. But I know that they're trying. And that's my hope, is that this is coming from a place of love and that it's not coming from a place of scorn. And I would rather me correct them. I would rather them learn it from me than literally anywhere else. Because I'm sure if you, like, look up trans rights on YouTube, you get a bunch of, like, what the hell is that that fake-ass university called?
PragerU.
How did everybody know that? Yeah, you're probably going to get a bunch of PragerU shit, and it's going to be, like, abysmal, and they're not going to learn anything. But sometimes you have to like suffer and ask these questions and hope that they're learning. You know, one kind of half-baked idea that I had was opening up a very warming and welcoming space, and perhaps some of the other folks in this room who are not queer can give me some feedback on this, of just like a very much Las Vegas style rules, nothing leaves this room, what happens here stays here, of just ask a trans woman anything. Like, I know that you are thinking about stuff and you have questions and you have ideas and you want to know more and it's coming from a place of love, but you don't want to be weird and ask these things. Like, establishing something like that, so like queer people, trans people, cisgender people, straight people can have like some type of open dialogue, because I'm very much an open book. I've gone on podcasts and talk about surgeries that I've had, so I've definitely bared everything that I've had to the public auditorially. Yeah, it's a hard question, and you have to really push people and not give it, like, understand that you should not back down if somebody's being rude to you, but I don't think that you should also like jump down people's throat immediately. You know, applause to people who do that. I think it's funny, but I really want people to learn. I was on NPEC for like 2 years, and education's really important to me, so I'll stop there. I would like to think that I can teach folks who don't know transgender people what being transgender is like, but like how we can unite in this struggle, because I'll be honest, trans people here in the room, there's not a lot of us. Like, percentage-wise, numbers-wise, there's not a lot of us. We have cisgender comrades, we have good ones, and we need to unite to fight together. It takes all of us. And yes, there's going to be conflict, but we can work through it and beat the brakes off the capitalist system.
Yeah. I mean, I guess regarding generational trauma, or not trauma, sorry, that was a Freudian slip. Generational conflict.
2 more minutes till we get to the question about trauma.
Okay. I think it's really important that we as socialists not be afraid of change. And I understand that that is something that capitalism is very much instilled into us, and it can be very easily be something to slip into. But I think that now is the time on the left to be experimental and to try new things. And if they fail, it's like, well, we're all still going to be here. And if 6 months ago you told me that you were going to go like pitch a tent on your college campus for Palestine, I'd be like, that's a terrible idea. You should not do that. You're going to get arrested. And I have never been happier to have been proven wrong. But even if comrades, you know, let's say that this tactic was tried and it failed, like, I don't think that things would be worse off than they are today. So I think that, especially with us as people who are organizers who devote so much of our time and energy into DSA, if somebody says, well, hey, I think what we've been doing, we should do something else that we've been doing for the past several years. You know, this has been the norm, but we should try something new. I can understand how you might be very resistant to that. You may have put a lot of time and energy into that old method. But we have to remember that our tactics need to meet the situation, and that we cannot, you know, as the political landscape in the world is constantly changing, we cannot expect to try the same thing. We have to meet the occasion.
Yeah, I also love this question. So it is interesting in, you know, DSA is one of the only spaces I think a lot of us have been in that is genuinely multi-generational, because we've eradicated those spaces from our society. We don't have them, right? You go to school and you're literally with people who were born within 6 months of you on either end. Like, that's it. And then odds are good that you end up in a work, you know, if you're in a white collar workplace, which DSA disproportionately has, white collar workplaces tend to be clustered around specific age groups. Nobody goes to church anymore. I can tell you, I'm allowed to say that as an ordained ruling elder of the Presbyterian Church, which, by the way, is very funny because I am super young in those spaces. I'm like, they're like, oh, it's little Megan. And I'm in DSA. And I'm like, yeah, I'm all everybody's mom. So it is like we actually do have to learn to navigate that in just a, you know, psychosocial way, like just how do you talk to people who are your mom's age but not your mom? How do you talk to people who are your kid's age but not your kid? And it's a challenge, and you have to work through it. And I think we do sometimes also we'll fall into sort of deference politics about that, with the idea that we just assume that because the person is in our space and represents a type of person, whether that's a parent or a trans person or an elder person or whatever, that they represent all of those people. And we don't like think through the fact that the reason they're in our space is likely because of something that, so like I should not represent all moms in DSA to you, because I am in a very, very specific space. My partner is a musician, so he's home all day and he can like be with our kid when I take off, which is not a thing. And also my kid's 14, he's not 4. So I have some flexibility as a mom that a lot of moms don't have. So I don't want people to look at me and be like, well, Megan's a mom and she does it. No, I have like just incredibly strong support system, and also like an easy kid, which, yeah. All right. There we go. Whew. So you know, and I think it can. God, my glasses won't. What about comrades with glasses? I don't think we've really thought through the. We, you know, do a thing where it's like, well, yeah, that person's a YDSA member, but they're like one of the good ones. They're not like one of like the childish ones, or that person's an elder, but they're good at technology and not like the other. And it's like, okay, there's no one type of person. I mean, I'm obviously not that good at technology, and I'm an elder millennial. I grew up with computers-ish. I literally grew up with computers. Like I had an Apple IIe in kindergarten, and then what were the colorful apples? The iMacs? Yes. Senior year. So that's my arc. I should be able to use my Google Calendar more correctly, but clearly not. But yeah, I think we need to remember that people just are multi-textured, right? Like we're trying to be collectivists, but that doesn't mean we need to lose our individuality or remember that each of us are good at some things and bad at some things and have difficulties with some things. Yeah, and we do have to learn that in this space, because there's not another space where we're going to learn it. It doesn't exist anymore. That was intentionally eradicated. That's what capitalism does. Breaks us out into our little categories, and there we stick. And it's going to cause conflict, and we have to get better at conflict and more generative and say, you know, do our oops, ouch, right? I'm sorry. I did not mean to offend you in that way. And I genuinely want to make it up to you and be honest when it's like, you know, that actually hurts me when you say that, or, you know, I don't want you to assume that about everybody who's like me because of this or that. Yeah, I think that's it. I'll just stop there.
Should we do questions after I finish?
Yeah.
The reason I wanted to ask that question is in part what I said about just, you know, kind of the pedagogical aspects of this. I feel in DSA and also in the labor movement too, it's like there's this long, like sort of, you know, this long chain, right? It's like we all know about this chain, right? We know about the way that, like, you know, movements have come up and then they've failed, or they have, like, you know, we've sprung out of other ones. And I think that sometimes we take it for granted that like there's sort of like, yeah, we have our ups and downs, but like the chain won't be broken. But I do think that, you know, in my experience as, you know, sort of doing this archiving workshop with Peg and other people who are, have been in, you know, the organization for a long time, is that the amount of care that they have is like so intense because of they know the people who have, like, you know, lived and died, you know, during this period. And I think that sometimes people of, like, you know, let's say my age and younger, which, like, people in the, like, kind of is like that looks that that's like book knowledge. Like, we know that that exists in books, but like we actually know people for whom that's the case. And I think that, one thing that has been really great about doing this archiving work is that it's sort of all different people have flocked to it as like a way to participate, because you have people who have been around and they have a lot of stuff, you know, like stuff as in material, but then they have so much knowledge that they want to share. And sometimes it's hard to remember that while we're doing like organizing or campaigning or whatever it is that we're trying to do to like meet the moment, like the very moment, that like these moments have analogs, right? These moments have things that have come before. And maybe like Alex said, it's like, it's not always like the correct tactic, but you don't know that until you actually look at it, right? And like the amount of knowledge that we have as socialists and the amount of like sort of collective shared desire to see socialism in our lifetimes, you know, that is the common thread. Like that's the real common thread, right? And so I feel like sometimes we intellectualize a lot of this stuff and it becomes very dry, right? But when we meet each other and when we have the opportunity to meet each other in certain ways, like for example, through this archiving work, we also want to start doing oral histories and recording them so that younger socialists can interview seasoned comrades and talk to them about their experiences. And that way we can have that too. It's a way to, you know, it's like, it's not dead history, right? Like this is actually the way that we make our movement, and we will have conflict because that's human life. You know, like we're all just sort of negotiating ourselves all the time, you know, like doing that. But like, I think that keeping that common thread of, that commonality that we all want to see more progress towards socialism sometime in our lifetimes. All of us have lifetimes, right? So it's we're meeting each other there. And I, you know, I hate to sound like Pollyannish about it and like, oh no, that's the thing that will stop us from fighting with each other. But it's something that helped me to like think about whenever I was working on this project too, that I was working on one piece of it and then other folks were working on this other piece of it. And it was, you know, it was like very positive for me, a very positive experience for me to be able to share that with folks.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.